The vastness of Alaska is home to many of us, far beyond city streets or the safety net offered by civilization. But we're never totally alone because first responders are available for search and rescue around the clock. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth, sitting in for Steve Heimel. Today we're talking to the rescuers who look out for each of us. Your questions, comments, and adventures are welcome at 1-800-478-8255. That's 478-TALK. It's a local call in Anchorage at 550-8433. Email talk@aprn.org. Find out how the search and rescue system works and how you can help it find yourself in trouble.
This program is underwritten in part by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. And by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, providing insight on statewide business and government issues. There's more information online at akbizmag.com. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Morning, Charles Wolforth here, sitting in for Steve Heimel on Talk of Alaska. And we have a topic that I think is going to be of interest to people and communities all over the state, because we're all getting ready to get out there in the sunshine and enjoy the outdoors. And there's always a few of us who get lost or get into trouble and need help. And so we're going to talk about the search and rescue system, how it works, how you can help the military, primarily military personnel who might be out to look for you and help you, and how you can avoid getting in trouble. I've got two guests with me right now. Major Carl Westerlund is with the Air National Guard Rescue Coordination Center. Thank you for being with us.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for the opportunity.
And on the phone from Juneau is Operations Specialist First Class Mark Lochtia. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Mr. Wolf.
Well, it's I guess the summer comes and the news stories start to flow about folks who have gone down an airplane or lost at sea or get lost hiking, and we kind of hear the outcome of it. But I always wonder, what is the first thing that happens from your perspective, Major Westerlund, when you know, how do you get the call typically that somebody is in need of help? And what percentage of those calls you get are actually where you're going to deploy somebody to get out there and look for them?
Well, typically there's several different ways we'll take the calls. Notifications first event in any search and rescue, and whether it's through the SARSAT COSPAS satellite system or through a neighbor or friend who notices someone hasn't come home in a few days, or through other agencies calling in and saying, hey, there's an event going on that may require help. In addition to that, we get notifications via the SPOT or spider tracks or the other, what we call the satellite emergency notification devices, handheld PLBs. All those feed into a kind of a central hub, which is the RCC, and then we go from there.
And you're located here in Anchorage on, I guess, what we used to call Cullis, now we call Elmendorf, Fort Rich.
Yeah, that's correct. The RCC, it's historically been associated with Elmendorf Air Force Base.
Okay.
Our facility is on the air base right now, and it looks to maintain and stay there for the long haul.
And who's actually, is there somebody sitting there 24 hours a day waiting for a call to come in? What do they do when they get a call that somebody's missing?
Well, we're staffed 24/7, 365. It doesn't matter holidays or floods or fires or anything. We're going to have a way to get a hold of people. Typically during the daytime, we'll have at least two people on shift, and then on the odd hours, we'll have at least one manning the station at all times. The first thing that happens is when we do get a notification, we try to validate it. If it's electronic signals or that type of thing, then we'll follow up with phone calls and solicit other sources that'll help find that information out. And once we determine there actually is a SAR event, that's when we start formulating a SAR plan as far as who's closest and who's best to go help out.
And just you have, evaluated all, there's a lot of different assets around the state. There's local folks, volunteer organizations, all the way up to, I guess, these guys who are trained to rescue fighter pilots if they go down behind enemy lines, right? So you got to figure out who's the best person to deal with each particular issue.
Absolutely, and we like to get the best responder and the first responder out there to the event site, basically quickest, and then build it from there. So we'll task everyone from the 176 Wing SAR team, the Air National Guard, the premier rescue asset in the state for the aviation stuff. We'll work very closely with the state troopers, the Park Service, the local city, government, town, borough. We'll call in and do a lot of coordination with the Coast Guard if it's coastal or if they have a closer asset, and basically just try to get the best guy there first to effect the rescue.
Uh-huh. So that must take a lot of advanced planning and knowledge to know exactly who's got what capabilities and where they are from day to day.
It's a constant training program to keep the controllers aware of who's where and what resources we have, and it's a always updated list. You know, historically, back in the paper days, it was a 3-inch thick binder of names and numbers and locations, and we've moved electronic on a lot of that, you know, computer-based programs and whatnot, but it's still a vast amount of data, and it requires constant update to make sure that you have the most recent data to get a hold of someone quickly.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, let me turn to the Coast Guard, and I'm pretty sure that I mispronounced your name. Operations Specialist Mark...
It's actually pronounced Leuchte.
Leuchte. Okay, I wrote it down wrong when I was talking to you beforehand. Well, so this Coast Guard also has a statewide coordination function, and how does that work? You know, if I'm on my boat, say, anywhere in Alaska, and I am in trouble, and I get on Channel 16, or I guess it's 22, which is the Coast Guard channel, and say, and issue a mayday, how does that get transferred to you, and how do you decide what to do about it?
Well, in Alaska, we have a VHF distress radio system in place with high sites spread all over Alaska. Sector Juno, who's co-located with us here, controls the southeastern Alaska high sites, and then Sector Anchorage has the high sites in Prince William Sound, Kenai Peninsula, and Bering. So most of our calls will come in over Channel 16 or Channel 22, and from that point on, we decide which is the best asset to dispatch, based on location of the individual.
And for most of Alaska, the Coast Guard's going to have to go quite a distance because you have a base in, where are your main, Kodiak is your largest base, right? Or where are the assets located primarily?
They're located in Juneau. We've got assets in Juneau. We've got them in Kodiak. We have them in Sitka. And sometimes we forward deploy helicopters out in St. Paul during the Opelio crab season, and then down in Cold Bay during the king crab season. We'll have two helicopters stationed right there, which will cut down our response time out in the Bering.
How do you guys coordinate with like the National Guard or the troopers or the other folks that could help out in these situations?
Well, it's going to basically come down to you know, with D-17, the Coast Guard here, we're the primary maritime search and rescue agency. But if we have, you know, say we have an emergency that's inland SAR, that's going to primarily be the Air Force. And as the major had said, some of our distress calls come in over the SARsat system. And from there, we'll coordinate closely with the Air National Guard or the Air Force and try to figure out if they need Coast Guard assistance.
And SARsat is essentially a beacon, which might be called a EPIRB or a PLB, which is something that sends a signal to a satellite with a GPS location. And when you get that signal, all you know is that the beacon has gone off, right? You don't necessarily know what's happened or if the person is really in trouble.
That is correct. And the majority of our SARsat cases turn out to be false alarms, but we run each one like it's, you know, until we find out otherwise, we're running it like it's an emergency.
So somebody left the PLB sitting out, and the five-year-old crawled up and pressed the button or something, and then how do you have to try to contact that vessel and find out if it's really an emergency? Is that waste a lot of your time, or is that how do you go about doing that?
Well, when we get the EPIRB hits, a lot of times the registration data will show up on the form. In most of our cases, it's just making a quick phone call, and the owner will either have accidentally set it off. Weather sometimes sets off the EPIRBs when the boats are out on the Bering Sea, and sometimes we've even had cases where somebody has thrown away an EPIRB and forgot to take the battery out of it, and then we'll have it going off in a dump site.
So you didn't answer the second part of, like, how much of your resources that way. It sounds like probably quite a bit.
It is. It doesn't really, you know, we get the EPIRB hit, and it's probably a good 10 to 15 minutes of making phone calls trying to figure out, because we're not going to know exactly what the emergency is. Unless it's an ELT, we can tell it's an airborne emergency.
Yeah, one of the great functions with the new 406 megahertz system is that the EPIRBs, which are typically the nautical beacons, or the 406 ELTs, which are the aviation beacons, or the 406 PLBs, which is what a hiker would carry, they're all set up to be electronically registered with contact data for the owner, vessel, or airframe tail number, and as well as emergency contact numbers. So on that first notification, when the satellite picks up that 406 signal, almost instantaneously, all that data gets transmitted to either the Juno or the Alaska RCC. And then with that data, if it's GPS-enabled 406, we get location. If it's not a GPS-enabled, it takes a few minutes for the satellites to do the math, basically, using some Doppler shift and geolocation stuff, and to come up with those coordinates. So really, the new 406s help a lot on tasking out resources, because I can solve most of our problems with two or three phone calls for those inadvertent activations, or for, like you say, a child may get a hold of the PLB and think it's fun to press the red button.
So the user is going to have to make sure they keep that data up to date. That's their responsibility, to get online and,
absolutely,
and fill out the form and make sure it's correct, right?
And that's one of the things that we run into every now and then is finding out, hey, this PLB was sold on eBay and some guy in the lower 48 now has it. So just yesterday we had a 406 ELT go off, and it was registered to an aircraft on Lake Hood with two owners. And you can only register one owner on the beacon, although they could have put the second owner's contact data on there. So it took us 5 or 6 minutes to get a hold of the actual owner, and then get the partner's contact information, track him down. And then it turns out that they had done a test on it and left it on just a little bit too long, and the beacon had picked it up. So,
So if anybody who goes out and buys one of these devices, whether REI, whether through some aeronautical supply, it's going to be the 406, the up-to-date one. There's not going to, unless you bought it used, you wouldn't get one of the old ones.
That's correct. The 121.5 signal is, as of 2009, it's no longer monitored or reported via the satellite systems. And so you really shouldn't be able to, you can still buy them on the market, but it's really not suggested. You're wasting your money for a technology that frankly puts the rescuers in more jeopardy, and it may delay your rescue for several days.
All right. Well, it's Talk of Alaska. My name is Charles Wolforth, filling in for Steve Heimel. We're talking about search and rescue, and we welcome your calls, input, questions, incidents. The phone number statewide toll-free is 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255. Spells out 478-TALK. And if you're in Anchorage, it's a local call at 550-8433. We also take emails and read those on the air at talk@aprn.org. And interested in hearing your questions, what would you like to know about search and rescue system in Alaska? We were talking about these beacons and how the Coast Guard the Rescue Coordination Center here in Anchorage dispatches rescuers to get out there. Huge distances that are involved. If you're going out into the wilderness or on the water in Alaska, you've got to be able to take care of yourself for a while before a rescuer gets there. I mean, what is the potentially, you know, it could, even if you know where the person is, it might take you all day to get somewhere. Is that true?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. We say that Alaska's got the worst rescue weather and conditions in the country. And you combine, if we'll just take the Anchorage Bowl, for us to take an Air Guard helicopter and send it outside the Anchorage Bowl, it almost Shirley's going to have to go through one of the passes if they're going out west. And oftentimes, you enter a completely different weather system, whether it's in the pass or on the other side of the Alaska Range. And the same goes for heading north or heading east. So the weather and the ruggedness and the altitude with the mountains really, really affects rescue. Typically, when we look at the weather systems, we say that for 72 hours is about the longest we typically see a weather system affect the state.
Mm-hmm.
So we try to tell people that even with the best equipped rescue forces in the world, it may be a day or a few days if the weather is just that bad where they can't get in. During that time, of course, we're going to be trying about every option we can to send all sorts of different assets, as well as dropping supplies if need be, if we can find your location.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I made a mistake just a moment ago in giving out the phone number. The local number is 550-8422. That's 550-8422 in Anchorage, and outside of Anchorage, it's 1-800-478-8255. Turning to the Coast Guard, Specialist Loitka down in Juneau, the issue of weather and how long it takes to get to somebody is obviously a big one on the ocean, because a lot of times when rescue is needed is when the weather is really bad. And I've heard a lot of these adventure stories. The Perfect Storm is a book about them, and you read that book, you think, well, that sort of thing happens in Alaska every year, right? These horrendous, risky rescues. And I'm curious about how the Coast Guard determines when you are going to go out and try to rescue somebody in a storm and when it's just too dangerous for your personnel.
Okay, well, what we do is to determine risk, we use a system called the Operational Risk Management. And as search and rescue personnel, we're always assessing the risk versus the gain in the cases. We've got numerous types of risk assessment models. One we most commonly use is the GAR model, which stands for green, amber, red. And what we do is we got five categories: supervision, planning, crew selection, fitness, environment. And what we're going to do here is we'll give it a score from 0 to 10, with 10 being the riskiest. And once we come up with the score, if it's in the red, what we're going to do is try to find ways to reduce the risk. It doesn't mean we're going to necessarily not fly on a mission, but we're going to look at ways we can do it safer.
So what kind of things would you be able to do if say it's a vessel in distress and in bad weather?
Well, we'll assess how fast we have to get a unit out there. We may there's been cases where we've had to wait till sunlight to fly, and if the vessel can wait, then we're going to try to wait just so we can fly in daylight, because between midnight and 0600 is our most dangerous time to partake in rescue missions, due obviously to lack of sunlight and the weather deteriorating.
Mm-hmm. So, but your guys are trained to go into to actually go in the water in when it's stormy and difficult. And I guess I'm interested in how you go about training the personnel who actually go out on these really hazardous missions. And I guess they have to size it up when they're out there, right, and give you the information about how dangerous it is.
Yes, when they get on scene, they'll size up the situation, and it's ultimately the pilot's call for safety out there on flying a mission. And as far as being deployed into the water, it's the rescue swimmer's call on whether he believes he can do the mission or not.
And is that different here in Alaska than it might be other places, given the extremes of weather we have and the extreme distances that you've got to deal with? I mean, I would imagine if you're, Long Island Sound in New York, and you're dealing with somebody who's just run out of cocktail mix, it's a little bit different than if you're out in the Bering Sea.
That's true. It's we have fewer cases due to the population size here in Alaska. I mean, by comparison, Florida gets about 5,000 cases a year, where we get about 650 or so. But when we do our cases, they're usually they're pretty big cases, and they involve a lot of inclement weather and rough terrain, and they're usually the ones you end up seeing on the news.
Right. Yeah. And so, sometimes really serious loss of life out in the, with the fishing industry. So, but what about in the summertime when I'm boating and listening to my VHF, I often will hear somebody who is supposedly in trouble, but maybe doesn't even know where he is, doesn't know how his equipment works. Do you run into much of that where you just think, well, the people are not prepared, and so the Coast Guard is having to be the backup for folks who shouldn't have gotten into a bad situation in the first place?
Well, to be honest with you, I haven't seen it that much in Alaska. I used to be stationed down in Woods Hole, and we ran into that all the time. People would go out, they'd run out of gas, and then they'd be looking for a ride back in from the Coast Guard. And in that case, what we do is we'll run a broadcast for any commercial assistance providers or Good Samaritans to assist with the individual. We'll go ahead and put it out, say we've got a vessel in need of assistance in a certain position, and if you can help out, please render assistance or contact the Coast Guard.
And the person, if it's their responsibility, if they're not in danger, to get back to port, essentially. You're not taxi service.
It is if it's a non-emergency, but there are certain factors involved that we have to monitor, such as the person's health, deteriorating weather. We may end up having to go out and get them if the weather just takes a turn for the worse.
Sure. So you'd rather hear from somebody than have them not call, I guess. True?
Yes, yeah, exactly. And as I said before, I've seen a big difference in the experience of the mariners up here in Alaska compared to down in southern New England.
Let me turn that same question to Major Westerland here in Anchorage. Do you run into a percentage of people who are out there and just in the wilderness and are unprepared and don't know what they're doing and get in trouble? Or is that a major concern for you guys or not?
It's not a major concern. It's definitely the exception rather than the rule. For the most part, when people head out in the wilderness, they go out with the intent of returning on their own. They don't go out thinking that I'm going to create a large news event. And so it's just kind of comes back to the level of training or the level of thought they've put into it, whether they step out of their vehicle and start walking and they're well prepared to spend hours or a night as far as food, water, shelter, and then signaling or contact devices. The best thing that we can have in the field is a active survivor who's trying to be rescued, and the kind of the worst case is one that's given up and is not trying to be affect their own rescue. So when we see guys that are say they're equipped with a 406 beacon that's GPS enabled, and they say they flip their airplane on a glacier when they're playing around, if they've got a well-equipped sleeping bag and a couple of Mountain House meals, maybe a stove, and they're prepared to spend a night or two, and that's a lot better for us to know that they're equipped that way. More often than not, it's the random exception when you get a guy who takes off out of, say, Nanana to fly to Fairbanks, and all he's wearing is jeans and a cotton T-shirt, and he tries to land at Sitabria, you know, on the river, and ends up flipping it. And so then you get the phone call saying, I'm not prepared to spend the night, and can you come pick me up?
So your guys kind of have to take a risk to deal with somebody who should have taken care of themselves. What about this issue I hear about people relying on cell phones and not being prepared, you know, in closer to urban areas? Is that something you've seen here, as they've seen in the lower 48?
A little bit. The benefit and what we've seen over the last, historically, is that with cell phone coverage increasing and the price on sat phones and these other devices coming down, that people are affecting their own rescue quite often, which is good overall, and it absolutely reduces the cost to the taxpayer when you talk about, you know, aviation fuel and dollars spent and resources allocated on a rescue. The cell phone coverage in the state, you know, typically hovers around the road system, and a lot of times we'll get phone calls where people will call their friend and say, I'm in trouble here, can you help me? And if the friend is not able to affect the rescue, that's where we get the phone call. And We manage risk the same way. It's not the identical system, but the theory is the same. And our crews, we call it crew resource management. Any crew member can basically say, hey, I don't like this is how this is going, or they can say, why don't we try a different a different method, or they can change their plan en route to mitigate that risk.
Mm-hmm. Now I'd like to go to Lou in Ketchikan. Lou, do you have a question?
Yeah, good morning. I was had some experience in this search and rescue more than once operating vessels around the state, and one incident that sticks out was the big storm in November 85 out west, and a vessel near me was swamped, and three guys perished. And there was a whole lot of vessels in trouble at the time, and I know that the center that handles these satellite EPIRB alarms was real busy at the time. But I was surprised to learn that they let the satellite make three passes before they finally said that this vessel's EPIRB alarm had gone off. And people need to understand these satellites are not geosynchronous, in other words, hovering in one spot over the Earth. In fact, they have a polar orbit, and sometimes the search and rescue outfits will wait for two or three passes. At least that's the way it was. It was explained to me in the investigation later. And in that case, we were pretty sure we knew that vessel had been swamped at 6:35 in the morning when they stopped returning the VHF calls. And the search and rescue center did not send out a broadcast until noontime.
Well, that was quite a while ago. Let's get a response from the Coast Guard. Would that be normal these days?
Oh, that wouldn't be normal these days. That's actually surprises me that they didn't send out a broadcast sooner than that. But sometimes we won't get a position on SARSAT right away, so it might take a couple passes. But usually we can get the ball rolling before then.
Can I? I'd like to jump in there. Talking about the COSPAS SARSAT system. Getting into some geek stuff here, so I apologize on that. But there's several satellites that make up the system. It's an international system specifically for rescue. Right now, there's four or five operational geosynchronous satellites, which are about 22,000 miles above the equator. They basically stare at the Earth's surface, plus or minus 75 degrees latitude. They never move. They're always in the same location, and they've got the entire Earth covered. In addition to that, there's the low-orbiting satellites, the LEOs. Those are about 500 miles above the Earth's surface, and they, at any one time, there's about eight operational, and they orbit over the poles, and they shift their orbit axis a certain amount of degrees every time they go around the poles. So worst-case scenario, the worst place to be on Earth is about 46 minutes for one of those orbiting satellites to see you. And even if they don't see you, one of the stationary satellites sees you. So the system nowadays is very robust, and there's backups to the backups in it. And that combined with the 406 technology is phenomenal for locating guys instantaneously and knowing they are having a problem and doing something about
it. All right. Lou, does that satisfy you?
Absolutely. That's exactly the clarification or new information I was looking for. And let me just say, the folks in the Coast Guard have helped me out many times over the 37 years I've been sailing around Alaska, and I just can't say enough good things about their search and rescue people. And I tip my hat to them every day. Thank you very much.
And I want to really thank Operations Specialist First Class Mark Loitka for being with us. We're going to go to a break in just a minute, and I've got some interesting callers for the second half who I hope will stay on hold. We are going to continue here talking about search and rescue in Alaska. Thank you, Specialist Loitka, for being with us.
Hey, no problem.
All right. And we'll be back in just a minute or two as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, NEA Alaska, promoting excellence in public education for Alaskan children through investment in education professionals. Online at neaalaska.org. And by Full Circle. Full Circle grows, picks, and delivers fresh, certified organic produce year-round. More information about their 400-acre farm and their organic partners at fullcircle.com.
And we're back on Talk of Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth, sitting in for Mead Treadwell. Our topic today is search and rescue in Alaska. I'm sorry, sitting in for Steve Heimel. My little mental slip there, because I was going to invite Mead Treadwell on the air, Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell, who has been doing some work on making sure we have proper search and rescue coordination among nations in the Arctic. Lieutenant Governor Treadwell, thanks for being with us.
How are you today?
I'm great. So you recently had some news to announce on the topic that we're discussing today.
Yeah, I really appreciate listening to the guys who were on just now, because they are the people on the front line and directing the people on the front line to make sure that we do save lives in Alaska. As Alaska's Lieutenant Governor, I joined Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, Lisa Murkowski, the Secretary of the Interior last week in Nuuk, Greenland, where for the first time in history, the eight Arctic nations came together to sign a binding agreement. And the first agreement that they've signed was on search and rescue, and it divided up the Arctic Ocean, which is becoming more and more accessible, and commits us as a country to work on exercises with our neighbors in Canada and Russia especially, but throughout the Arctic, to make sure that we improve our capability in this new ocean.
And what's the challenge up there? What are we concerned about?
Well, I think that the first thing we were concerned about was formally divvying up the responsibility, because once you know what slice of the pie you have in the ocean or the Bering Sea, then you can start to build the resources to fulfill your responsibility, and you can also have much better communication between these countries. But you know, we're concerned as a state that the Coast Guard is doing the absolute best it can with the forward resources and what we're doing on the Rescue Coordination Center in the state is very positive, that ultimately we need more resources in the north as more activity comes to the north. And so whether it's forward basing, as was mentioned, with the helicopters on St. Paul, and perhaps seeing that also on some northern coastal communities, whether it's getting the U.S. to replace the icebreakers that they commissioned during the Nixon administration that are now on their way out, whether it's doing more to hold hands with Canada and Russia to make sure that we've got assets to call upon, those are the things that are expected to come out of this agreement.
Are you expecting more shipping, more activity in the Arctic Ocean because of climate change and reduction in the sea ice out there?
Yes, we are. I think you can already see that the state of Alaska subscribes to some very interesting data that is collected by the Marine Exchange down in Juneau. And if you just look at activity in the Bering Sea, 2 years ago, the eight Arctic nations completed something called the Arctic Marine Shipping Assessment. And that showed that in 2004, ships greater than 100 tons, there were close to 5,000 of them either operating in the Bering Sea region or in the Arctic Ocean, adjacent ice-covered seas around the Arctic. And this year, we've read announcements in Russian newspapers that they plan shipments of oil, gas, condensate, iron ore through the Bering Strait from northern Russia to China. We know there are cruise ships that actually make visits to Alaska coastal communities like Barrow, where we've had search and rescues, or medevacs, actually, in that case, not a search and rescue, but a medevac, where we relied on North Slope Borough resources and resources that Shell had up there. And so we're interested in seeing as more and more shipping comes to this region that we have the capability for the long term.
The closest base being really Kodiak, which is like half a continent away.
Yeah, I mean, from Kodiak to Barrow is, I think, 900, 1,000 miles, and that's a long way in a helicopter.
Really?
The Coast Guard helicopters are not refuelable in midair. The Air National Guard ones that are a little bit closer are. As what was ice turns to water, you also want to see the capability to have more ship rescue.
Great. Well, thanks for being with us this morning. I appreciate your calling.
Good. Thanks for looking at this topic. It's pretty important. And, you know, as we looked at shipping, we're looking at the International Maritime Organization. They're working on safer ships for the Arctic, better code of conduct for passenger ships up there. This will help. And there's some other things coming along to help fight oil spills as well.
And I think Major Westerland has a comment.
Yes, sir. I just want to ensure that we're talking about the same stuff. We're the Arctic is very high on the radar for the search and rescue organizations across the military. It's we're very aware of the signing of that agreement. I was proud to hear that you went and represented the state. That was fantastic. We actually at the end of the month we've got the director of the Coast Guard RCC and myself and a few other folks are going to go up to Barrow and do our first site visit for a search and rescue exercise that we're going to execute in July, specifically talking about a cruise ship off the coast near Barrow and coordinating that response and exercising that capability as far as our search and rescue capability and the package that we'd send up there.
Excellent. All right. Well, my thanks to Lieutenant Governor Treadwell. And I'd like to now invite another guest on the air. Captain Barry Wilson is with the Alaska State Troopers and works in the search and rescue area. Captain Wilson, thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
What is the troopers' role? Well, there are so many agencies involved in this area. And I know the troopers do a lot of search and rescue. How do you fit in with the other agencies we've been talking about?
Well, it's kind of a triad of forces that really work to help do search and rescue in the state of Alaska. With the Air National Guard taking care of the air incidents that occur within the state, the Coast Guard taking care of the waterways, and they have different parallels that we break up for responses. And Alaska State Troopers are responsible for land search and rescue within the state of Alaska, ultimately. And we partner with the Park Service and with different boroughs that do search and rescue. The North Slope Borough does search and rescue up in the Arctic Range to make that happen.
And what kind of assets do you have? You have a helicopter. You have posts around the state. What I guess you may be the closest one in most cases, eh?
Generally, ourselves and or our VPSOs and VPOs that we work with closely within the communities coordinate search and rescue. It really, when you ask the question about what is our asset is people and our coordination with people that make it happen. Because if you just relied on us coming out and doing search and rescue, you'd be waiting a little while. Ultimately, it's the volunteers throughout the state of Alaska that do the search and rescue in Alaska.
So you guys know how to activate the local volunteer organizations and just regular folks who want to go out there and help?
Ultimately, yes. We coordinate with those folks. We try to help provide training to augment the training that they do on their own. People, some of the organized groups like Alaska Mountain Rescue Group, the SAR Dogs, Sitka Mountain Rescue, there's a myriad of folks, and I'll miss them all. But we rely on them to do the meat of the work, and we coordinate with them and provide them the resources, provide them the transportation if necessary to get out there and do the search and rescue for the folks.
I'd like to turn now to a caller, Wendell, who's calling from Dillingham. Wendell?
Yes, I'm here.
Go right ahead.
Yes, I just had a question regarding the new SpiderTrax GPS-based, actually it's an internet-based system, where it combines GPS and satellite phone. And as I understand it, one of the air carriers here showed me his system where on startup, when he takes off, it starts tracking him every minute he has it set on. And it tracks him throughout his entire flight, and then if he were to have a landing in some unplanned place, when the aircraft system shut off, then immediately it sends out signal warning, basically, that and then the internet goes into play and so forth. I'm just wondering if there's any experience with this system yet in operation.
Major Westmoreland?
Yeah, absolutely. That system is a really exciting new capability, and overseas there are a couple of different countries that have adapted that as a suitable substitute for the 406 ELT requirement on aviation side. As far as our work with it here at the RCC, typically if a SpiderTrax event happens, one of their call center folks would call us and notify us of the of a SAR event or some sort of distress notification, and then we would act on it. Typically, we would call one of Trooper Wilson or Captain Wilson's individuals and coordinate with him on who's got the closest resource to effect the rescue. That in combination with a SPOT or the 406, you know, the more capabilities you add, the quicker you're going to help yourself out. I know with the SpiderTrax, there's a lot of preloading, if you will, on the velocity gates and the number of times it tracks your location or reports your location, whether it's one every 2 minutes or every 10 minutes, and as well as being able to say, hey, I'm gonna mess around and connect for 20 minutes at a different, you know, strip, and so don't report me as overdue. So there's some exciting functions with that. Nationally, the NOAA folks are working and trying to find out a way, if there's a way to get that SpiderTrax emergency notification into our, basically the national architecture that we get the 406 beacons on. And the same thing goes with the SPOT and the other vendors that offer that type of capability.
So is this, I know that one of the key things for search and rescue is knowing the person's missing, right? And so you got to, you know, it's leave a flight plan, leave a float plan, let people know when you're missing. Is this a way that you can use technology to be reported missing, reported in trouble much faster than you would normally have under the old kinds of systems?
I think it augments it well. You know, the old system, when we talk about a typical flight plan where if you're more than 30 minutes overdue, they start looking for you, and more than an hour overdue, they start activating a search as far as generating resources and doing a very active look for you. It's the same thing, except for now you're going to have your spouse or a good friend initiating that rescue attempt.
Wendell, does that answer for you?
Yes, and I appreciate you taking that call.
Great. Thanks for calling. Now I'd like to go to Joe, who's calling from Anchorage. Joe?
Yes, hello. One of the things I'd like to point out, and it's probably been pointed out before, is that there's a great number of rescues that aren't involved with ELTs or PRBs that are initiated because somebody's just overdue, hiking or climbing in the mountains or whatever. And those get handled through the Alaska State Troopers, and the troopers then send out teams of volunteers, like the Alaska Mountain Rescue Group and other volunteers, search and rescue groups. And I think it's important to note that, you know, while people that are flying and people that are in the ocean should file a float plan or a flight plan, it's also really important for just regular people who don't have the personal locator devices to put a trip plan in their car and put it in an envelope and fold it up, and, you know, so that if we do look for somebody, we generally try to go to the vehicle where the, you know, point last seen was and get into the vehicle and look at that trip plan to see it. It really helps to get an idea of what they plan to do. And if the weather is a factor, they should have a plan A and a plan B. So, mm-hmm. And put it in the car.
Let's throw that to Trooper Captain Barry Wilson. Is that one of your major challenges? Is that you say, oh, so-and-so was supposed to get back a couple of days ago. We have no idea where they are. I would think that would make it much more difficult.
Certainly. Leaving a trip plan with the vehicle, leaving a trip plan with a trusted individual that will report you missing, is really saves us a lot of wasted effort doing that research to figure out where someone had gone, what they were going to do, and how prepared they were to be out and about.
All right. So that's kind of
another good way of notifying is, you know, a lot of people now are, you know, you've got satellite, but you've also got a lot of people with cell phones. So, and there is a tendency to sometimes get a little bit too codependent on the fact that I got a cell phone and if I have coverage, I'm going to get saved. So it's a good idea to just not wait until you're in trouble to light off your cell phone. And having that trip plan is a real plus.
Let people know where you are. All right. Well, thanks for the call, Joe. We are going to be back with more of Talk of Alaska as we continue.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Finn Air, with 50 years of flying experience and offering charter service throughout Alaska and the United States. Details online at finnair.com. The University of Alaska Fairbanks now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
And we're back with Talk of Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth, filling in for Steve Heimel. In the studio with me today is Major Carl Westerlund of the Rescue Coordination Center at Elmendorf Air Force Base. And on the line is Captain Barry Wilson of the Alaska State Troopers. You can get involved by calling 1-800-478-8255. That's toll-free, and it spells out 478-TALK. Or if you're in Anchorage, you can call 550-8422, and we also take emails at talk@aprn.org. And here is an email. Steve says, we've been listening to your show. There's been no reference to the U.S. Coast Guard cutter, U.S. Coast Guard helicopter in Cordova or a cutter in Valdez. Also, Civil Air Patrol flies several SAR missions in Alaska each year. I think the helicopter in Cordova may be seasonal, that they just get, once the activity gets going in Prince William Sound, they get that one out there. And I guess we've been talking a little bit about volunteer rescue. Captain Wilson, Civil Air Patrol, volunteer groups, just regular folks out there. Is there ever a concern when you're dealing with volunteers and amateurs that they may get in trouble while they're looking for somebody? Is that do you have to screen them in any way, or do you just sort of just figure people are Alaskans, they're going to know what they're doing and take care of themselves?
Well, you would think that, but that's kind of probably some of the people we're going to look for, are Alaskans that we were hoping to take care of themselves. So the reality is, no, we don't just take, you know, folks from anywhere and say, they went that way, go look for them. That's not how you do a real professional search and rescue. We get with organizations that we trust, that we've worked with. When we have new organizations start up, we go and participate with them in their training and learn their procedures and their protocols for the search and rescue, and then we use them in conjunction with other groups that we feel comfortable with, so that we build up that trust level for that. When we send somebody out to do a search and rescue and we coordinate with them and use our ICS planning system for who's in control and who's managing, that we aren't creating more of a hazard. Because if you just send somebody out willy-nilly to go look for somebody who's missing, you may just be creating more of a problem that we all have to go and fix later. And we have some really, really professional volunteer organizations that do search and rescue throughout the state, from southeast to the villages on the west coast, all the way up. North Slope Borough has a wonderful system up in the north. Just to give you an idea, when you talk about the number of searchers in the state of Alaska in 2010, the state of Alaska Department of Public Safety had about 498 searchers doing search and rescue. That'd be paid employees doing search and rescue over the year. The military, about 306, using our numbers. It might be a little different, certainly from the major. But our volunteers, we had 2,300
wow.
volunteers go out and do search and rescue. You know, we spent about 3,300 hours. They spent 20,000 hours doing search and rescue in the state of Alaska. So when I say we rely on our search and rescue volunteers across this state to do search and rescue, I'm not just saying it. We really do.
That's huge, yeah. Well, I know a lot. Sometimes there'll be individual cases that rack up huge numbers of hours. For example, there was the tragedy of the National Park Service personnel who were flying down the Alaska Peninsula last summer, who I don't know if they ever were found, but the search went on for a long time. Either of you fill us in on what happened with that tragedy?
I believe the Park Service still has it considered as an open search because they've never located the individuals. They did locate the aircraft wreckage, and so they've determined that the airplane has wrecked, but they haven't closed out the search because they don't have any physical evidence of deceased individuals at this point.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes over history, I guess I wrote a newspaper article about this maybe 20 years ago, that there were something like 50 aircraft that had disappeared over the years, never been found. The most famous one was Congressman Nick Begich and Hale Boggs disappeared back in, I guess, 1970. But there have been others, and going back to World War II, you know, there are even some large aircraft that disappeared. We've talked about technology and beacons and all that. Is there anything else for either of my guests that people should think about if they're in this situation to make sure they're found, to make sure that they're visible for a search? Major?
Yeah, we always like to tell people to have signaling devices available. Nighttime flashlights or the headlamps that have a flash setting are great. If you want to, you can actually go out and purchase high-intensity strobes that you could set off for nighttime use, and that's actually very beneficial. Our crews go out on night vision goggles, and which amplify the light, and so it really stands out. In addition to that, daytime shapes that don't occur in nature as far as straight lines and right angles with contrasting materials are a good way to get a searcher's attention, as well as a really smoky fire, anything like that can make yourself stand out. Worst thing we can have is a guy that hunkers down underneath a tree and does not make himself available for rescue.
So he's like maybe not thinking clearly, and he's sort of huddled and not thinking about the fact that he needs something to let people know where he is.
Absolutely. And if you're in a situation where you need to hunker down for warmth and shelter, you can always make something out away from your location that's at least close and get the searcher's attention, and you know, as a static symbol that maybe be seen from the air.
Mm-hmm. Captain Wilson, we were talking about searches that take a long time, and I know the troopers' resources are limited. How do you make that decision about when to stop searching? I know it has to, every year it happens at some point that you just can't keep looking.
You know, that is probably one of the more difficult decisions that have to be made ultimately, much as was done by the Park Service looking for their lost personnel. And it's even harder, you know, when you know the people. It's hard enough for us dealing with the families and having to explain to them why we've curtailed our searching. Because from my perspective, we never stop looking for people. And that's what I tell folks. We never stop looking. We're curtailing our looking to not putting the resources out there that we have been putting. And the decision is complex, because it's never the same, whether it be an air search. A couple of years ago, we had a huge air search up going towards Canada that we never found the plane or the individuals. But, you know, we still have the locates out there for folks. When they fly through those areas, they keep an eye open for the plane, any wreckage or new wreckage. I know the Major has a big Alaska up there with pins in the wall for where wreckages are currently located, so we can compare them to known locations to when new ones get called in. But, you know, that's a decision we have to make, and when we've exhausted, you know, most everywhere we could possibly look that we can think of, we follow the leads that we've been provided, and then we make those decisions, and they're not easy ones, and they're ones that we do as a group, as a organizations, with our volunteers, with our the families, and so everybody's brought into those decisions before we make them to curtail a search.
Do you ever get situations where the family wants to invest their own money or hire people to search and sort of have to advise them about whether this is really worthwhile for them or not? I've heard of that happening.
We certainly have had that happen, and you know, the families will do what they need to help with that whole grieving process for having not been able to find somebody. And it is difficult, because I know if it was my family, I would be doing the same thing. I'd want to go out there and look. But, you know, we try to advise them the best way to do that. We try to advise them the safest way to do that, because sometimes going out there, you could putting yourself in danger. And, you know, we have the volunteers that are professionals. They're professional mountain climbers. They're professional hikers that know the areas and know the safety procedures, and they have plans to make sure that kind of thing is done by the family, too, if they decide to go forth and do those efforts, or if they're hiring somebody.
Is there any difference, and this I guess could go to either of my guests, between someone who is say an ordinary person's gotten in trouble, and somebody who's doing a very risky activity because that's their recreation. And you know, we've had a couple of tragedies this week on Mount McKinley. There was an air rescue at 19,000 feet. Just seems like that would be incredibly dangerous. For some people, I think there's an ethical issue about folks who are putting themselves at risk, and then the rescuers have to put themselves at risk. Do you guys ever wrestle with that, or is that sort of just something you set aside, and if somebody's in trouble, you go after them? Major?
Typically, when it comes to when a rescue is declared, we will go after them. We'll apply those operational risk management strategies to eliminate or mitigate that risk to the rescuers, but we don't get into the he should have or should not have been there situation, because honestly, you know what, you take a guy from the lower 48 and you put him, you know, out just outside of Wasilla, and maybe he should have never been there.
Right.
Whereas you take a highly trained mountaineer, and it's just a sliding scale, and it's very hard to quantify that and assess damage, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. From the trooper's perspective, are there rescues that you would be more or less likely to go after? For example, I guess if the weather's not bad, you might leave a little bit more time before you launch, or how do you evaluate that sort of decision?
You know, that's every situation is different. Depends, as the major so eloquently put, whether it's, you know, a highly trained person, we might, you know, be looking at that with different parameters than if it was the person from Florida that's now in somewhere on the Arctic Range. A whole different parameters for where we're going to look for them, how we're going to look for them, the safety that's necessary for it, what they're prepared for. It sets up, you know, your accident circumstance and your need to rush out and do something is different, as depending on the circumstances they're provided. And we have this checklist that we run through so that we have some concept of what we will rate that as for a need.
So you'd rather have the loved one call and say, I'm worried, rather than have them hold back and decide whether it's time for a rescue, and you'll decide if it's time for a rescue.
100%. You know,
absolutely.
Nothing's more frustrating than at 11 o'clock at night as the sun's going down, they're calling up and going, yeah, he was supposed to be back at noon, but we were just hoping. You know, I'd rather be called and said, this is what's going on. I can then get resources available and find out what options I have for search and rescue. And it may be the next morning because of weather conditions, lighting, that we have to go out later. But we are prepared and have people in place to go do that.
Well, thanks so much for being with me. That was Captain Barry Wilson of the Alaska State Troopers. I've also had Major Carl Westerland from the Rescue Coordination Center in Anchorage. My name is Charles Wolforth. Next week, Steve Heimel will be back. He'll be talking about the gold rush. And I've enjoyed being with you, and it's been fun to sit in. So that's it for today for Talk of Alaska Statewide. Thank you.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.